to connect this morning for me, afternoon for y'all. And I'd like to ask if we can talk about the reality management worksheet.
Let's go for it.
Let's go.
You've got the floor, sir.
Thank you. I have shared your work even amongst friends, even a few. And even though I don't know it well, I'm very blessed by it. And talking to others about it, one may be on the call today. And this question came to being because she was asking me about the reality worksheet. And I realized I need to know more about this. I've done it. I've done it a few times, but I don't really understand it, and certainly did not want to lead anyone with the wrong impressions. So I invited them to join, and I'm going to learn more. They'll learn more, and we'll all learn more. So that's a little bit of background. And, Michael, I'd like to ask if we can review. Thank you. I'd like to ask if we can review when to use this worksheet. I've got in my mind when we get triggered or angry by a situation in life. Would you expound a little bit on that, please?
Really? Now, let me ask you a question. So a situation in your life can make you angry? Is that what I just understood you to say? Really?
Yes, I'm trying to.
You know, I didn't know that was possible. I'll have to check in on that.
Yes. Work
so let me give
my
you
corner,
a.
I can tell you.
No, it doesn't work worth a damn. I promise you, it never will. It keeps us in a cycle, and it points up how subtly our minds work to keep things hidden. So now you give me some history from your side. Let me give you some history on the worksheet itself. I was first introduced to the first century Aramaic idea of forgiveness about 43 years ago now. And I was introduced by a gentleman, a giant of a man named Daniel McDougall. Dan was an attorney in Albany, Georgia. He was from a fairly wealthy Atlanta family and had been a very successful real estate attorney, made some money. And a friend of his, who was a Superior Court judge, you've heard me speak of him before, Asa D. Kelly, wanted something to be able to offer in the prison system. And he went looking. And one of the things that I can remember Dan saying to me over and over and over again was how, as he inquired and as he looked for, how do we resolve the insanity going on within the prison system and, of course, by extension, within the world? One of the things he did was he had an interaction with a man from British intelligence. And this man from British intelligence said, if you can find something that you can take into the prison system to cut recidivism, you'll have the answer. So Dan started to work with the first century Aramaic idea of forgiveness. And he actually created a course called EMI, Emotional Maturity Instruction. And with EMI, and then when Dan and I met, we had been traveling parallel roads. He'd been working with the first century Aramaic language and actually guided a group of 25 of the world's top Aramaicists in working to establish the first century meanings of the words of Yeshua, the man who's popularly known as Jesus, but it is not his name in any way, shape, or form. If you break down the word Jesus, you've got Hail Jesus, which, you know, if you were going to take a rabbi to the Greco-Roman world, you probably weren't a very popular person. And so they looked for a name that they could call this rabbi named Yeshua, and they came up with Jesus, which translates Hail Zeus. Everybody knew the Greek god Zeus, so he became pretty palatable. And that was the beginning point. when I first started to work with this, there was a rather primitive worksheet, and between Dan's work and my work, we'd been traveling a parallel road working with the Aramaic language, and I more from the health side, his more from the prison side. Actually, there was a point where Dan, his wife and family were in such hostility at the fact that he turned his attention away from making, you know, being a fountain of money in the real estate business to working and investing in what it took to create or reduce recidivism in the prison system. His family actually tried to have him committed as a result of the fact that he turned his wealth and his intelligence. By the way, he was a naval officer in World War II. And when the Navy did IQ tests on their officers, he was number 4 in the U.S. Navy during World War II in IQ tests. He was pretty amazing. So we started to combine our work. And eventually, as a result of that, emotional maturity instruction was eliminated, and it became laws of living. I had been teaching a course that I had developed called Lessons in Living, actually, that I took to children and such. And so when we combined EMI and Lessons in Living, it became Laws of Living. And with that course, we cut recidivism in the jails and the prisons by over 90%. And actually, the Aramaic translations were not considered valid until those translations could be taken into the classroom and produce the result that they purported to produce, and that would be a mind that would be fueled and motivated by love. So there's a little bit of the history of the worksheet. And if you don't get the worksheet the first or the second or the 10th or the 100th or the 1,000th time that you do it, then you're in good company. At least I'll consider myself good company here. The worksheet that you're looking at, the 7-step that we use currently, the first version of that, as I said, it was rather crude back then. It was about 43 years ago. And I haven't tracked exactly how many edits were done, but there were days. The Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, which presented that worksheet process, there were days where I did that workshop as often as 3 times in one day. And that worksheet would go through 5, 6, 7 major edits in one day. So you're looking at version probably at least 2024 of that worksheet. And it wasn't until I had worked with the forgiveness process for close to 35 years, and I'm talking about full time. I mean, again, you know, there's one particular time I was traveling, and the city of Tucson, Arizona hired me to come in and teach to city workers. That was one Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, and they wanted the group separate. And that's a 3-hour workshop. And so I did one for city workers, and then I did one for police, and then I did one for fire and emergency personnel. So that's how often that workshop was taught and how engaged I was with it. And it took me 35 years to really comprehend and to be able to explain why and how such an absolutely ridiculous thing as looking at a perfectly wonderful goal that you hold in a situation where there's disturbance or upset, why forgiveness would look like canceling that wonderful goal that you hold for whoever it is that is the object of attention that appears to be the cause of what's happening in your mind. Now, why would you do that? And so before we get into the actual worksheet, I'm just going to do a short explanation of what it took me 35 years to learn. One, perception, the world we think we see, we do not see with our eyes. The world tells us, and you know, 99.999% of the world believes that we have a set of eyes, and our eyes show us an accurate picture of what is happening in the world. Well, my background's in physics, electronics, with a side study in physics. And here's what I know. Antennas are one-way valves. In this case, the eye is an antenna that brings light energy, information, into the mind. And we've been tricked into thinking that we can accurately say, and then I see what happened out there. But this antenna that receives information, being a one-way valve, means that we don't see out of the eye what's out there. The information that comes into the eye resonates content in the individual mind, and there's a time delay, if I remember correctly, it's about 7/10,000ths of a second before the brain generates the picture that it sees. I'll help everybody to anchor that thought with a little story that happened with my granddaughter a few weeks ago. She was wanting to watch an anatomy and physiology video, which she's at four, just enamored. At three, was an enamored, would sit for 30, 40 minutes watching a YouTube video on anatomy and physiology. And a few weeks ago, she was making some Play-Doh parts of the human body. She likes to make the kidneys and the bladder and the intestines and the stomach and the esophagus and place it in this doll, this model of the human body that she has. And she was doing that, and she said, "Papa, I want to watch the anatomy video." And I said, "Okay, sweetie, let's go." And I go and turn on YouTube, and we find the video. And it's an animation of a cartoon-like character with all the organs, you know, inside of the body. And the organs all fall out of the body onto the ground as the video starts, in order of size, the smallest organs first. And then each organ sings a song to you to tell you what its part is. So this is a kid's educational piece on anatomy and physiology. When it's the eye's turn to sing, they sing a song. And the song goes, "I am your eyes, I am your eyes, I see the world around you." And Aria looks at me and says, "Papa, they don't understand. We don't see with our eyes, we see with our brain."
Wow.
So a fraction of a second after information comes into the eye generates a construct called perception. And the thing that drives or controls the picture that our brain generates, the construct our brain generates, is the goals that we hold. Now, there's some interesting Harvard research that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing, the max amount of data that goes into conscious awareness in that time frame, which is about a 25th of a second, is 9 bits of data. So we metaphorically, not meaning to be absolutely literal, but I metaphorically call that the 9-bit mind. Each of us is looking through a 9-bit mind. There are approximately 10,000 bits of data resonating within us in that time frame that our brain generates based on 9 bits of data. The world that we think we see out there, but is really being generated within us as a construct, and that construct is driven by the goal that we hold. If we don't have a goal for an object of attention, our brain doesn't give us much information about that particular object of attention. So there can be 1,000 things going on in the environment, but if what we're interested in, you know, somebody's sat and, you know, they've been watching a movie and they're all ensconced in the movie, And something rather dramatic happens right in the room with them, and they do not even perceive it, because not having a goal means there's no attention given to the energy coming in from that, and they miss that thing altogether. Everybody understands that one if they've ever had a conversation with someone and they're thinking about something else, and this person's explaining something to them, and 20 seconds later, this person says, "Now, did that make sense?" And you go, what was that? What did you say?" Nothing was heard because the 9-bit mind was filled with something different. So when I realized that my mind literally generates the world that I experience on every level, and that it does so selectively according to the goals that I hold active at that moment, then I find this genius Yeshua from 2,000 years ago who, and God only knows, and I mean that quite literally, how he understood this, that what we see is driven or controlled by the goal that we hold for whatever object of attention is. And we've developed the language based in projection. And most of the language, as you subtly said, well, those, you know, doing a worksheet on something that makes me angry. You know, my offering is, nothing has ever made anyone angry in all of history. But if there's anger in there, and I have a goal for an object of attention, that object of attention refuses to fulfill for me, and that object of attention might be you, and it might be me, it doesn't matter. Whatever that object of attention is, if I hold a goal and I'm not fulfilling it, I'm going to tend to generate perceptual constructs that mean I'm down on myself. And if I have a goal for you and you refuse to fulfill that goal, then I may take my anger and use it to build my brain's image of you. So I'll literally project, I'll build a picture of you out of the unresolved anger in me. And because I now see a picture in my mind and experience a feeling of anger that I've got attached to that picture, I'll really believe that you're the cause of my anger. But again, the truth is nobody's ever been angry with anyone in all of history. But most people who carry anger will find any given object of attention at any moment to be responsible. You made me angry, you made me sad, you made me afraid. So once it's understood that perception is a construct of the mind driven by goals, then the core of the worksheet is to look at and acknowledge honestly what I'm feeling, what my goal is at the moment where I'm experiencing something that's less than love. Then, because healing happens when I take the unresolved parts of my mind that hold rage or fear or sadness or hatred or vengeance or grief or condemnation or gossip or slander, when I hold those energetic patterns, and I project them into my brain's image of someone else or myself. That process is always driven by, my perception is driven by, the goal that I hold. So the core of forgiveness is, once I recognize the goal that's driving my pain's perception, that my mind massages into a picture that has me believe that my pained perception is caused by you, I have to cancel that lie that I've so fallen in love with that the pain in my life is everybody else's fault. I have to cancel the driver that keeps perpetuating that lie in my mind. So when I cancel the goal, whatever it happens to be in any given situation, that's driving my projection that you're the reason I'm doing this to myself again, you know, the title of my book, and I really feel blessed that the universe reserved this book title for me, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Virtually everybody, when they hear that title, gives some kind of a laugh or clenches their jaw and experiences anger, because virtually everybody's asked themselves that question. And the reason is because when I load a goal into my mind that causes my mind to pretend that you're the cause of what's happening inside of me, then I have to dissociate from the real cause of what's happening inside of me. I have to formulate, I have to hide the truth and build a picture of how it's all your fault. But of course, in my workshops, I have this, one of my favorite tongue-in-cheek lines is, you'll notice if you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people, you're the only one that was there every time. It's about you. It's not about whoever the them is. And that healing happens when we can bring the hidden or dissociated part of the mind forward accurately, rather than experiencing our pained content by putting into our brain's image of someone else and believing they're the cause. When I apply forgiveness a la first century Aramaic Yeshua, I cancel the goal that's driving this pain perception. My pain perception collapses into its root. This opens a pathway into the underlying hidden energy. I like to use a visual for that, that is kind of from a rather tragic thing that happened in America, but everybody's got this visual burned into their minds. And that is, we all remember when the 9/11 towers went down. And here are these buildings that are dozens of stories tall, and they, in free fall speed, collapsed in on their own footprint. When you cancel a goal, pained perception, just like those buildings, collapse in on their own footprint. When they do, the footprint that has been dissociated from the cause, that's been literally inaccessible because we live in denial of it, is now open to exposure. And rather than putting that cause into our brain's image of someone else and believing it's about them, we get to experience it directly. And when I can experience something, whether it's mine from my own personal experience or something that has come from my bloodline, from my generations, you might remember in the ancient scriptures they talked about the quote they gave us. And before I give that quote, remember that in Aramaic the word sin is an archery term that simply means off the mark. If someone fired at the bullseye and missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper would call out sin, off the mark. You missed the mark. And so when one is in denial and dissociation, their mind is off the mark, and that energy that's creating pain is inside of them. But again, the mind uses that hidden information to build our brain's image of someone else, and we can then successfully believe that it's somebody else's fault. But that never leads to resolution of pain. When one cancels the goal that collapses the errant pained perception, the mind's lie, that what I'm experiencing is somebody else's fault, and that perception collapses in on itself, I can access the underlying traumatic energy directly and do that in the presence of active love. So you notice that the step before you cancel your goal, what you do is you tap in experientially to the presence of love. And if love is active and present, and when I talk about love being active and present, I mean the true experience of ourselves as who we are, as active love, our created essence, not the mamby-pamby, mushy love idea of our world that love is sexual athletics or love is laying your head on the chopping block for someone else to take it off and you sacrifice yourself. We're not talking about that. I'm talking about that love as a fact, as a true state of being, is present in our physiology. At the moment we cancel the goal and bring the underlying pained content forward directly, by the very exposure to love, that pained content dissolves. Now, it tends to dissolve in stages. You know, you might remember there's a particular case, I think it was Peter, that asked Yeshua, well, how many of these worksheets do we have to do? How many times do I need to forgive as to my brother? And he asks, he says, is seven times enough? Like, if I do seven worksheets around this issue, is that enough? And in Aramaic, what Yeshua answers is, no. Now, the Greeks translate it as seven times 70. But in Aramaic, it's 77 times 70. How many times will I forgive around any given issue until I've cleaned out my whole genetic history of pain around that given subject? It may be, and if you look at those numbers, 77 times 70, 70 is a number of completion. And when we add that 7 to it, or pardon me, 7 is the number of completion, 0 is infinity. I'm going to do an infinite amount of work around my dissociated pain and my generational patterns of pain. I'm going to do an infinite amount of work until I'm finished with that. So it may take more than 1 or 2 or 10 or 100 worksheets, and I may have to forgive 20 times in a minute, until I get out of the habit of projecting my pain onto someone else's image. You know, Carl Jung talks about how we are religious people. Humans are religious, naturally. And everybody's got one. I don't care whether you're an atheist or not, it doesn't matter. The atheist religion, generally speaking, is the religion of blame. The easiest alternative to the truth of I'm a creator and I set up what happens in my life and I need to take responsibility and clean up my own mind. The easiest religion is blame. Notice, just listen in the culture, watch the interviews on television for a few news cycles, and you'll notice that the religion of most people is a conversation about blame. That's what they believe in more than anything. The worksheet process takes us back from that conversation, back into adulthood, back into responsibility. And rather than, you know, there's a passage in the scriptures where they you know, talking to Yeshua, and he says to them, you're like a bunch of little kids in the square. Na, 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 look what you did to me. And it's time for us to end that and recognize that if I'm experiencing something in my structure, in my mind, in my perception, if I'm experiencing something that's painful, I have a problem, and I've got to stop believing that it's about everybody else. And if I choose to be finished with it, then I'm going to apply first century Aramaic forgiveness. So in a nutshell, that's a little bit of history and an explanation of what the worksheet is about. Does that fit and make sense for you, Michael? And does that leave you with any questions?
Thank you. Michael, thank you for repeating this. I know I've heard it many times. I think you've gone over this with me personally at least once before, and it's becoming clearer. So I really appreciate that. I appreciate the historical aspect of it. I didn't know that part before. Very interesting. And I have a couple quick questions.
Gold, go for it.
I have asked you before. I'm a little confused on this. For instance,
okay,
at a certain time of the day, you have a program, and people are counting on you to be on that program. So
right,
that is a goal. I'm guessing it's a goal for you, and it would be a goal for me to connect at my time of the day and be able to speak with you. So that's a goal on both parts. Now,
correct.
How does this work? And another side of goals that I see is if I'm expecting my neighbor to do something and he doesn't do it, then that is also a goal, which isn't necessarily a particular moment in time. It's just something we may have spoke about. Now, are all of those examples part of the goals that you are speaking about?
Absolutely. And the reason why that's true, and oftentimes we'll have people who try to change the worksheet and change the forgiveness process, and they'll talk about, well, you know, you just have preferences, so it's about preferences, right? It's like, no, it's not about preferences. And the reason for that is because perception as a construct of the mind is driven by goals and not perception. Perception does not create stress. Goals create stress. For instance, let's say, you know, we're going through, we may extend this conversation out until tomorrow to complete this worksheet that we're going to do. We'll see what happens. But let's just imagine a scenario where we get into a really deep worksheet and we step through it, and by the end of the show tomorrow, that worksheet isn't complete. And there, let's say we don't have any other conversation about it, but there's an assumption, let's say, that you might make that on Monday we'll pick it up and do it again, because we've done that with several shows. Well, we'll just pick it up the next show. But here, Jeannie and I are going to take a week's vacation, our first one in 5 years next week. And what she did a lot of work. She went into so that we could cancel our goal to do the radio show next week. She went in, there's a video recording that we did on called Aramaicisms. It's a 4-hour live workshop between myself and a fellow named Dale Allen Hoffman, where we talk about the title of it being Aramaicisms, a term that I coined, representing our objective and our work in bringing back the original meanings of Yeshua's Aramaic words. So what Jeannie did is she went in and rendered the video into an MP4, and then she converted the MP4 into an MP3, took the auditory track off of it. And so that 4-hour workshop is going to play 1 hour on Monday, 1 hour on Tuesday, 1 hour on Wednesday, 1 hour on Thursday. And then Dr. Tim is going to select, and I think he's going to do a show where he interviewed Dale Allen Hoffman for the fifth day. So we could imagine a scenario where Monday, you know, you maybe expect to finish that worksheet and you call the show. You've got, of course, a goal for me to be there, and I'm not going to be there. Now, what kind of responses might we see? Well, one person might say, oh, he's on vacation. Gene's on vacation. Great. They needed that. It's been 5 years. That's wonderful. Another response might be, why, that SOB. We're in the middle of a worksheet, and he goes and takes a vacation. Who the hell does he think he is? And all kinds of stuff might fly out of one's mouth in response to the fact that, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Michael's not there for support. And, you know, he's been there for 11 years, and here this is the first time we've taken a vacation like this. You could imagine all kinds of things coming up in a person's mind who holds those goals for me. And, you know, when I'm in the middle of a worksheet with someone and we go, okay, we're going to pick that up tomorrow, I have a goal, too, that tomorrow we'll get through that. So I might have to cancel a goal or two on Monday, or guess what? The goal to complete that worksheet is a way that I would create a stress in my mind. And we do a workshop called Getting the Stress You Need, and it's a big focus in our course, Laws of Living, that I was talking about earlier, as the how stress is created. And you can go all around the world, which I have done, and you can look for every stress expert you can find, and you will not find, at least in decades of looking, you will not find one person that can tell you how stress is created. You'll find people who can tell you, well, you should breathe, or you should go out for a walk, or you should count to 10, but you won't find, that I know of, anywhere that can tell you how stress is created, until you come to laws of living in this work. And guess what creates stress? Setting a goal in your mind. That's the cause of all stress. There are no stressful situations. a person who walks into what someone else might call a stressful situation, who doesn't know anything about what's going on and doesn't hold any goals for it, walks into the situation and, well, it's a situation. Doesn't mean anything to them. There's no meaning given by the mind because there's no goal held for it. Well, somebody else is standing there in a fit of rage because the situation isn't going the way they want it to. Goals create stress. Preferences don't create stress. Desires don't create stress. Goals create stress. And the functioning purpose of your mind and my mind and every mind on the planet is to resolve stress. That is, to achieve the goal. There are only two ways to get rid of a stress once a stress is created in the mind. One way is to achieve the goal. The other is to cancel the goal. I remember back in Atlanta years ago, there was a woman who did some work with and did a worksheet with. And in that situation, she was really down on herself for being promiscuous. She shared with me that she had been promiscuous all her life and didn't want to be that way, but just couldn't help herself. And what she touched into in doing the work, the worksheet process, the forgiveness process, was when she canceled the goal that was involved in this whole idea of self-disapproval and being promiscuous, she had a memory come up. And the memory was of being a very young girl, like 3 or 4, and having an uncle that she just deeply, deeply cherished. And the memory was of being that young girl with this cherished uncle and her uncle pushing her away, rejecting her. Now, as far as she remembered, there was never anything sexually inappropriate with him. But what she realized was that she had a goal for the kind of closeness that before she was pushed away, she had with her uncle. And it was just a sweet closeness with this man that she cherished deeply. And for the first time in her life, when she canceled the goal to be close to her uncle, she found herself back in control of her own sexuality and didn't have to jump into bed with every man that she went out with. For the first time in her life, that driver to regain that intimacy disappeared from her life, and she was back in control of her own sexuality. A goal in the mind of a 3-year-old that's never been canceled still enters behavior. You ever watch somebody and you say, God, they're acting like a 3-year-old. Do you know why? Because what's driving behavior at that moment is the unresolved, unfulfilled goal of the child of 3 and the stress created by the activation or the resonance of that goal. And so the core of forgiveness, seeing as how the functioning purpose of the mind is to take all the data that it has and structure a picture, a set of guidance parameters, that if one does what that guidance is, at least theoretically will fulfill that goal. That's the purpose of the mind, is to build a reality to show us how to complete the goals that we hold. The goals that we hold are insane, that our realities are insane. If the goals that we hold come from 2, 10, 20, 50 years ago, they can still be driving our minds and our mouths and our behaviors today. And we go, where did that come from? And what happens, again, when one cancels a goal? And it took 35 years. I understand why the Greeks came up with forgiveness is about how I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me because you're my object of attention and I'm in pain, so it must be your fault. But when Yeshua steps in, he says, no, cancel the goal that's creating the stress right now that's driving your perception. And when that collapses, you get to the root of what's really going on. And when you're able to access and remove that energetic trauma, that no longer drives your mind or your life. How many people have done something against their own will and choice to say, oh, no, boy, I did that terrible thing yesterday. You know, this happens a lot with alcoholics. Oh, my God, I found out what I did after I'd had those drinks yesterday, and that was so terrible, and I'm never going to do that again. And they mean it. I mean, they're sincerely repentant, and they're never going to do it again. But they don't know the goal that drives their perception under that particular stress. And if they never go in and resolve that, I guarantee, as with, you know, virtually every alcoholic, the next time they're in that situation with that stress, they do that behavior again. And, you know, the spouse says, well, you said you'd never do that again. Well, no. Oh, I this time I really mean it. But if they don't have forgiveness and they don't know how to find that driver in them, and the circumstance activates or resonates that goal past, and it may be a goal that's 10 generations old, they're going to do that behavior until they get to the place where they can collapse into that underlying energetic pattern that creates this behavior prompt that's so insane. Until they can do that and remove it, forgiveness hasn't occurred. So if there's ever a place where one finds themselves out of control of their own behavior, saying, oh my God, I wish I had never done that, better engage in forgiveness, or the next time the circumstances are right. If you don't go in and remove that goal, and it's activated by circumstance, the mind's going to serve out that perception once again. And in, you know, 43 years or so of working with people directly with this worksheet process, one of the most amazing things, you know, I hear you're sharing with some friends, and if you do worksheets with friends, here's something you're going to find just so amazing as you go through it. And I'm talking about, you know, doing this over a period of years, is you are going to be flabbergasted. You are going to be absolutely amazed when you sit with someone and walk them through that worksheet and they cancel that goal, and then all of a sudden, bang, a totally, completely unconscious, foreign, you know, seemingly impossible memory comes forward. And what people drop into, it always amazes me when they engage in forgiveness. What, especially if they're doing the process, sometimes people will say, oh, well, I just do the worksheet in my head. Well, I have a song that I sing to people who do worksheets in their heads. And you might remember it's a Paul Simon song, and it goes like this. Slip sliding away. You know, the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. When we get close to what's at the root of a trauma, we tend to go running in the other direction, expanding our denial and wanting to blame someone else. When one does the worksheet process in writing, and I'm saying this from personal experience, the things that, you know, if we were just doing it in our heads, you can kind of push aside and not pay attention to, you can't do that so well when you're doing it in writing. You have to start writing everything down, and you start paying attention to the subtler thoughts that need to be healed, and that's where the really deep work happens.
This is really something. So when we are in denial or dissociation, that is when we project, we're projecting onto someone else.
Right. There's a cycle. And you know, you watch that video of Why Is This Happening to Me Again, at 3 hour. And anybody that would like a copy of that, drop us a note. And, you know, I've got an article, actually, I'll send you with several links in it. But the latest 3 hour Why Is This Happening to Me Again video I just did back a few weeks ago. And in the past, that workshop has always been either an audio track CD that people would buy, or a DVD that people would buy, or they'd do it live, and it was always free when I did it live. But we've chosen to take this latest 3 hour Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop and make it a freebie, so it's in that article. And so you'll remember at the top of the board that, you know, the first word I usually write on the top of the board in the center is the word deny. And we have a specific definition of denial in this work. Denial is whenever I think or speak as though something outside of me is the cause of what's happening inside of me. So when I say, you made me mad, in essence, I'm giving my mind an instruction. You know, the mind is an evidential device, and the only thing your mind can do is give you evidence of your own BS. And of course, that's belief system. Somebody might have a different reality for those initials, but when I use that, it's belief system. So when I say, you made me mad, now I've been through this mad, again, 87 different times with 42 different people, but if I live in denial of that, I say, you made me mad. And in essence, what I'm saying to my evidential mind, remember, my mind's going to select 9 bits of data out of 10,000 brain cells firing. There might be 9,991 bits of data that show me clearly that this is mine and it's all about me. But when I say, you made me mad, in essence, I'm saying to my mind, mind, I know there's lots of evidence that shows me that I'm responsible for this state of being mad. But you're not allowed to use that data. I want you to hide that data away and show me information that that person over there is responsible for me being mad. Now, if there's no evidence whatsoever in my mind that proves that that person is responsible, my mind will make it up, will hallucinate it. And if you watch somebody, if you've ever had an interaction with someone and they pronounce how you're the problem in their lives, and then you prove totally, completely, logically, and irrefutably that that is incorrect, in an instant, they'll forget that they said that, and they'll come up with another reason why it's your fault. And if you make that illogical and ridiculous as a belief, they'll forget that they told you that piece of lie, and they'll come up with another way of blaming you. And I've watched people do 8 or 10 different, totally different stories around why, you know, trying to prove that it's someone else's fault. And once one lie is shot down, the mind has to hallucinate another. So that's why we have a workshop called Communication. Did you hear what I think I said? Because when we speak projection speak, you made me mad, we're instructing our mind to show me a construct that proves that you made me mad. That's denial. When I deny, when I think or speak as though something outside of me is the cause of what's moving inside of me, I have to dissociate from the real cause. I have to hide it from myself. It's like I've created a file on my computer. I put a password on the file. I closed the file and I threw the password away. I can never access that file again. In denial and dissociation, the content that would show me that I'm the cause of what's happening to me is now totally and completely out of my control, out of my sight, and out of my awareness. It's locked away and hidden until I find the password. When in that state, and the mind has instructions to make up a way to blame somebody else, then the mind has to use false data to produce its perception, to produce its construct that shows that somebody else is the problem. The password for getting to that dissociated part of the mind is always forgiveness. When I apply first century Aramaic forgiveness, I learn something about myself that I didn't know. I learn what it is that I've dissociated from in my own mind. And when I cancel the goal that drives that whole process and keeps it unconscious, then my perception collapses. And when my perception collapses, I get back to that original true cause. When I bring that forward to conscious awareness in the presence of love, then that content heals. And that is first century Aramaic forgiveness. And the timer on the radio show is telling me, and it's like this is one of the fastest hours I've had in a long time. The timer is telling me we're down to 60 seconds.
You didn't do projection.
Giving my mind instructions to blame somebody else, I'm projecting that content. My mind uses the very data that I've dissociated from to build my brain's image of someone else. And that's how projection works. So projection is taking something that's inside of me and making it look like that something is outside of me. So now I get a picture of you being the cause of what's happening inside of me. And the way that that projection is collapsed is by canceling the goal. And we're running out the clock. We're down to just 10 seconds. So if we can continue this worksheet tomorrow and the questions about it, let's go for it.
Let's do
work
it.
For you?
Thank you all so much. Yes, sir. Thank you
awesome.
Very much.
Hey, we're going to separate this one out as a separate show. Great questions. Great conversation. Have a blessed one, my friend.
Thank you.